This is a download from the outdoorstation.co.uk. You're listening to the tale of three podcasters walking across Scotland during the 30th anniversary of the RAB TGO Challenge. Part 12.
This podcast is just one from a special series produced from a wealth of recordings made in May 2009 during the 30th anniversary of the RAB TGO Challenge. Recording the event were Andy Howell, Shirley Worrell and me, Bob Cartwright. We were just three of the 360 or so challengers who were walking the unsupported 200 miles from the west to the east coast of Scotland. This was the 30th year of the event, sponsored by RAB and, of course, TGO Magazine, who have been behind the challenge ever since its inception in 1980. The framework and principle is totally unique. It isn't a race or competition of any kind. The objective is to foster good fellowship amongst walkers within the framework of a challenging 200-mile expedition. This is a backpacking trip, and everyone carries what they need for the duration, picking up the occasional food parcel along the way. The start consists of a series of sign-out locations on the west coast, anywhere from Torridon in the north down to Ardrishaig in the south. Each challenger, solo, couple or group, makes their way via a high route, a low route or the mixture of the two across Scotland to finish anywhere between Arbroath and Fraserburgh on the east coast. There's a set two-week window to do this in, and each participant submits their route for inspection prior to departure for safety and advice reasons. The places are normally limited to 300. However, on this 30th anniversary, this was increased to 360. Details about the future events, entry forms, past stories and photographs can be found in the October issue of TGO Magazine. Plus, in recent years, there's an ever-growing online library of podcasts, diaries and blogs from numerous challengers dotted around the web. Each participant makes the challenge as easy or as hard as they wish. The extremes can be a remote high route, carrying everything you need, navigating your way across wild country, taking in the magic vista which only Scotland can offer, and not seeing another soul for days on end. Or a route taking in the many social meeting places, not camping at all and using established warm, dry accommodation all the way. Most people do a mixture of the two in different forms, depending on the ever-changing conditions an event like this can throw at you. On this 30th anniversary, three of us took audio recorders with us to share our experiences and those of others we met along the way. Rose and I started from Oban, Andy Howell and his partner Kate from Torridon, and for the first time this year, Shirley Worrell was to give us a solo female perspective, also starting from Torridon. We were all aiming for different finish points on the east coast via completely different routes. And so this is our story. At this stage in the trip, Andy and Kate had already made it to Montrose. Rose and I were a day behind, staying at North Waterbridge campsite, with Shirley, who was following on not far behind. During one of the nicest evenings of the 2 weeks, there must have been a good 50 or so of us at the campsite, enjoying the last of the warm sunshine. And here I had the good fortune to meet once again overseas challenger Sean Grund. Meanwhile, in the bar of the Park Hotel, Andy caught up with first-timer John Hancock and another overseas challenger, Rob Housam.
Regular listeners will know Rob Housam, who we first met on the challenge a couple of years ago, and we've had several chats on podcasts since then. Rob, be back again this time with your wife Lisa. Didn't quite go to plan this time, but it looks as if you've still been enjoying Scotland.
Well, that's true. I didn't. Yes, so we started out on our plan, but we did have to make a change a few days into it. Lisa just found that she wasn't able to deal with. She had some back issues and wasn't able to keep going on the trail the way she had hoped. So when we got to Coogee, she decided that was as far as she was going to be able to go this time. And so I went with her, and we converted the rest of the trip into seeing some other bits of Scotland and just having some good times together. And it has been a good trip, just a different one than what we had planned.
I think it's important for people to realize that actually, you know, it's not a failure if you injure yourself or hurt yourself on the challenge. I mean, it's a pretty tough walk, and you know, we can all turn an ankle or hurt a back at any time, really, and there'll always be another year. But I mean, I think you've got to say to Lisa, well, you know, well done for trying it, because it's very different from the kind of walking that she knows at home.
Yeah, that's really true. And so it was there, you know, even though there's a sense of disappointment and not being able to do it all, there's still a very strong sense of accomplishment as well. And she feels that way, and I do too. We've had a great time, and looking forward to celebrating with everyone here at the end in Montrose. And we didn't want to miss that, so we've arranged to, you know, to make sure that we were here tonight, and we'll be heading back to the States on Sunday, as we had planned. But yeah, like you said, it's you know, these things changes do occur, things happen. You know, there wasn't any serious injury here, but it was just an aggravation of a long-standing issue, more so than what you know, I know at least expected, and what I had hoped as well. But these things, you know, it does happen to other people as well. I've certainly heard a number of stories, and I know some have dropped out this year. I don't know what all the reasons were, but I think everyone should consider it a success for whatever you're able to accomplish.
I think that's right. We've met a few people who've been driven down by extremely bad weather and high winds off some of the high Cairngorm mountains and passes, and you know, they've kept themselves safe, and that's the main thing. Now, when we spoke last time, we were talking about shelters and gear. 2 years ago, you were using a tarp system.
Yeah.
But with Lisa, you're looking for something that you could pretend was a tarp and she could pretend was a tent.
That's just about right, yeah.
But you hadn't decided on which model to bring. So how did it work out in the end?
Well, what we ended up deciding to use was a Six Moon Designs Lunar Duo tent. It's it's an ultralight, two-person tent, sil nylon. It's a single wall design. Uses trekking poles for support. And I'd have to say that overall, I was reasonably well pleased. I, given the fact that we didn't actually use it as extensively as we had planned, I actually end the trip with still a few questions about how it would do under certain circumstances, but it's for the use we've made of it, which was a number of nights out, it's been fine. It's kept us dry in the rain, not a problem with that. You know, we've slept warm and dry, which is really the goal. The only thing that I would say that I haven't been able to test yet is its performance on in very high winds, like the first couple of nights out. Actually, we didn't use it, and those would have been the two tough ones.
There's a couple from Seattle on the challenge who've got exactly the same tent.
Oh.
And perhaps we'll meet them later, but they were saying that they put a few extra guy lines on it, and they were reasonably happy in the high winds. So certainly a bit of endorsement. And how much does it weigh, that system?
It's just right at about just a slight bit over 1 kilo. 2.2 pounds. I did also use extra guy lines because, you know, testing it out at home, I felt it needed the extra security. So it basically stakes out normally with 6 stakes, and I added another 6. It has another 6 guy points, and I put lines on all of those, and even had it considered possibly double guying the two main, the ridge line stake. So I could have had a total of up to 14. I actually used 12, but I didn't have any problems with it either. I just didn't test it in the very highest winds.
It's a big tent, isn't it? It's certainly got as much room as, say, a Hilberg Nalo. And if people want to find out about it, you can see that on the Six Moons website. Now, you've been playing around with some other shelters, and we've still got Colin Ibbotson with us, and I'm looking at system next time, and I can't decide whether really I want to faff about with a tarp for 2 weeks, but there are some quite promising new designs, pyramid shape particularly around, and I know you've been trying some of those out, haven't you?
Well, I've got the one I have now and have still testing basically is the Mountain Laurel Designs Patrol Shelter from Ron Bell. I've got the Cuban fiber version of that. It's extremely light. I actually don't recall exactly what the gram weight works out to be. I'd have to go look it up again, but it's very light. It's a modified tarp design, basically with a rear panel so that you can block it off from the from that end. And also, my version has a little bit of a beak at the front, a little more protection from rain and wind blowing from different directions. And I'm very excited to give it the full paces too. If I'd been coming by myself this year, that's what I would have brought, and would have been interesting to see how it did, but I have high hopes for it.
I think the use of spinnaker and Cuban fiber in some of these one person shelters or pyramid shelters that are kind of like cut down versions of the Go-Lite Hex, with light material. I mean, theoretically, spinnaker and Cuban fiber, Colin, they're very, very strong textiles.
It is a very strong textile. It's only when you start sewing it that it exposes certain weaknesses. But I think in that kind of design, the panel size will be much smaller, and I think the loads will be correspondingly smaller as well, so it could work really well.
I'm tempted to try one of them out next time.
One of the things that I keep thinking about is the fact that these fabrics were designed for use with sailboat sails, and so obviously they're designed to be used in this sort of somewhat similar application, and I see no reason to think that they shouldn't perform quite well for tents.
We were talking, Colin and I were talking to somebody in Inverness in a gear store on the day before the challenge started, and he was one of them was a sailor, and he was telling us stories about effectively a little thin piece of spinnaker holding up a whole boat with something like 10 people on it. So it should have the strength. Okay, well, Rob, you made it here one way or another, and you're looking forward to this evening?
Yeah, definitely. So it's of course I've only had the opportunity once before, but it was it was great at the end of the long walk to be able to celebrate. And tonight it'll be more of a vicarious celebration, enjoying it for all the rest of the folks who did complete the walk. But we'll celebrate our own part that we did and the other things that we were able to do. And so yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to it.
And of course, as soon as you get home, you can start planning the next crossing.
Absolutely. Already planning it, as a matter of
fact. As we've said before, this TGO Challenge thing, it's addictive.
Yes, it is. And I do. There's a good chance I'll be back. I certainly would like to do that. And we spent yesterday evening in Edinburgh to see a little bit more of the city there, which is course quite different than the smaller places we've been in the last few days, but we hadn't had much time at the beginning of our trip to see it, so we did that. But on the train back from Edinburgh, I was already planning my route for the next time. So.
Now, while I've been walking across Scotland, I've been taking the opportunity to have a chat from time to time with some of the interesting local people that I've met along the way. I'm sure that everybody who's done the challenge has noticed how easy it is to get into the habit in the evenings of chatting away with the same old familiar faces, either in the hills or on the campsites or in the pubs. And whilst it's always lovely to catch up with old friends, there's a great deal of pleasure to be had from meeting new people too. So I was delighted to spot, as I walked along the path a little earlier this morning, a challenger new to me, just lying in the bushes at the side. And Agnes, because Agnes is in fact who it is, has agreed to say a few words for the benefit of listeners. So good morning, Agnes.
Good morning, Shirley.
Now, are you a first-time challenger, or is this one of a whole series of challenges for you?
No, this is actually my very first attempt across Scotland.
And is it the sort of thing that you'd anticipated?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I hadn't actually given it a great deal of thought in advance, but I've been enjoying the experience, certainly.
And so can you tell us where you started?
Yes, I started in the car park just outside the Shieldbridge Hotel.
And how long ago would that have been, Agnes?
I think it's probably about 7 or 8 days ago now.
And had you done a great deal of planning before you actually embarked upon the trip?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I hadn't really done any planning at all. I've been walking with Robert, and indeed it was Robert who did all the planning. And really, since the walk began, I've felt like, a little more than a passenger, to be perfectly honest. Robert's the person who's been doing all of the significant work.
Well, I'm sure that's not true, Agnes. Even if Robert's the person who's been carrying most of the kit, there's always there's the joy of companionship and chats in the evening.
Well, I'm not quite sure about that, because Robert hasn't actually said a great deal. Anyway, I've been enjoying the experience.
OK, so are you able to tell us anything about your route?
Well, yes, certainly. I started on the top of a piece of heather right outside the Shieldbridge Hotel, and as Robert passed, I leapt from the top of the heather onto a position approximately halfway down his left gaiter, and from there I slid down the gaiter to the point where his gaiter met the bottom of his trousers, and I sneaked into a small crack. I then managed to make my way round to the back of his left ankle. And that had actually been quite a treacherous and exhausting undertaking, so therefore I stayed there for a day or two before I began to make my way up the back of his leg towards the back of his knee. It was my intention to press on towards his groin, and I did do that, but I found that the going underfoot was really quite boggy and wet in places, but I didn't allow that to deter me, and eventually I got there, and I found that all the effort had been worthwhile. It was a lovely, warm and comforting place. And so really I just bedded myself down and spent several days there doing really very little indeed. Just taking a bit of a rest stop, really.
I see. And so how does it come to be then that we find you at the side of the path this morning?
Well, everything was going absolutely fine until a couple of days ago, when unfortunately we ran into absolutely appalling weather conditions on the evening of, I think it was probably the night before last. It took the form of great torrents of a scaldingly hot, soapy water in a B&B that Robert had booked, and I'm afraid that I was washed away. I was washed right out of his groin and down into a porcelain shower basin, and it's taken me a day and a half to crawl out of there and onto the side of the path where I've been attempting to dry out. Robert's gone on without me, and I think that unless I'm able to identify some other sort of companion, I may have to withdraw from the challenge.
Well, Agnes, I'm terribly sorry to hear that. I mean, I'd be more than happy to offer you a lift myself, but unfortunately, my pack seems to have filled up with all sorts of exciting things that I've been able to purchase at walking shops along the way, and of course, I'm actually carrying a smaller pack than the one that I set out with, having replaced my Atmos with an Exos in Aviemore, and so whilst I regret it, I'm sorry that I'm not able to offer you a lift, but it could be that if I just sort of carefully lift you up onto the top of that piece of heather over there, you may be able to persuade somebody else as they walk along the path a little later in the morning.
Well, thank you very much. That's probably my best bet.
Well, OK then, listeners. I'll carry on. I'm looking for a nice lunch spot, and the rain seems to have stopped for a while and the sun's on its way out, and of course that's always very encouraging. So I hope that you've enjoyed my interview with Big Agnes, and if the opportunity presents itself, I'll be more than happy to introduce you to some of the other new challenges as I meet along route. And so from me, that's that for now. Goodbye.
One of the first people we met on the challenge was Sean Grund on the Falls of Lorna as we came out of Oban. And here we are at North Waterbridge now, where there must be a good 50 or 60 tents of people camped up for their last night before going into Montrose or finishing somewhere near Montrose tomorrow. Lo and behold, Sean is one of them, and I'd love to catch up with him and see how he's got on with all his equipment and also his travels, because he had a very erratic path that took in a lot of peaks. He was full of young vim and vigour as he left us, and I'm just thought that it'd be worthwhile catching up with him now to see how he's got on and what his thoughts are on the challenge, if it's changed his views from his initial perception of what he was approaching and to actually what he's achieved. So first of all, Sean, congratulations for doing everything you've done.
Thank you.
And yes, what are your thoughts now compared to how they were on the first day when we met you?
It's about the same. The enthusiasm ebbs and flows, but it's been a lot of fun. It's been an experience for sure.
When we first met you, I looked at your route plan, which, to be absolutely honest, I could only understand half of it. I recognised some of the names on there, but you seemed to be zigzagging all over the place, and you described it yourself as a bit of a zigzag. Have you actually stuck to it all the way through?
Yeah, the end point's always always met up, but I didn't go up as many peaks as I wanted to just because of the weather and just distances and stuff. but I think I ended up going over to, I did Buckleight of Moher and Loch Nagar. But the rest of them, the good weather days we had, I didn't have any plan for that day. It wasn't in the area. But yeah, I went up and over a couple and zigzagged around a good bit.
Well, I can certainly tell you, you've earned a lot of respect from the people that have been doing it for several years here. Your name has been mentioned by lots of people who've met you on your travels, and I think most people have met you because you've been all over the place. You've had your pinnacle pack, and you've had 2 weeks' worth of food. You carried the whole lot. I must admit, when I first saw you, I thought that was a bit of a load. Did you feel that was the right thing to do now in retrospect? You could have picked food up as you go along?
Logistically, it was easier to plan. But about the third day in, I was regretting the decision. But I think it was a good experience to try and do it unsupported. It was nice to know that, you know, for 2 weeks I can carry all of my food. I think when I do it, the next time that I do it, it'll definitely not be carrying 25, 26 pounds worth of food. It'll be, you know, a day or two here and pick up the food and buy it as I go, or find little shops and stuff like that. It'd be a lot easier than doubling the pack weight or tripling it just to... I have to buy it in country.
The impression that I got when I spoke to you first of all was that you were making this, as you say, an unsupported trip, but also in the spirit of the challenge. It's quite a social event as well as a sort of a physical challenge itself, and the practicalities of it all. Do you feel that, as you can hear in the background, do you feel that you've understood more about the social aspect of it, of recently, certainly mixing with a few more people than you did initially?
Yeah, I think the first 3 or 4 days I was kind of on my own, going against the flow of everyone, so I'd see people for 5 or 6 minutes and then pass them by. But as I get a little bit farther, you start to walk with other people and you talk to them and you find out who they are and where they're from, and you talk to the people who are from around here as you pass through the towns and stuff, and you get to know the culture and kind of, you know, what everyone else thinks about, you know, this trip and their experiences, and it's a lot of fun. You learn a lot from just walking with someone.
But do you feel that your approach to it, when you initially heard about the event and any research you've done beforehand, perhaps as if you knew what you know now, obviously you can never do that in real life, but if you know what you know now, would you look at it slightly differently?
A little bit, yeah. It'd be nice. I had about 3/4 of the challenge where I was walking by myself and then meeting up with people at the end of the day, which is sort of fine, you know, if you're doing more of a physical challenge. But I think it's a lot more of a social event than people think about. And once you've done it a couple times or even once, you start to realize that, you know, it's a lot more fun when you're walking and you're experiencing it with someone else while you're, you know, traveling in groups of people, and you can talk and you can, you know, meet up with them later and catch up with a different group, and you don't have to do it all by yourself. It's not so much, it's less about the actual backpacking and more about the actual social and the cultural aspects of it.
Well, we're all sharing the same sort of interest and passion, aren't we? Certainly, it's been very interesting because every time, obviously, we met you on the first day, and all the other different groups of people that we've met along the way, we've all been asking, where's Sean, or have you met Sean? And surprisingly, most people have. So you've obviously, you've made a great impression on people, so I must congratulate you on what you've achieved. You've achieved a great trip. How's all the gear panned out? I'm sitting in front of Henry Shire's tent at the moment, and it's fairly minimal, but you're down to the last few bits and bobs, and your pack looks virtually empty because there's no food in it.
Yeah. I got one small cut on the pack coming down Buckleight of Moher, but it's not a stress point. It'll be a small patch. It's fine. Everything held up well. The tent withstood some of the wind and the rain, and has worked very well so far. This is the biggest shirt I've had it out with, and it's the first lightweight tent I've ever had. So it's nice, you know, little single skin, just keeps the wind and the rain out. But yeah, I didn't have any gear that really broke or failed or didn't live up to the expectations. A couple of things that, you know, probably didn't use as much as I had planned or probably could have done without. But in the end, I think everything got used and everything lived up to the expectations.
Excellent. Are you using a meth stove? Do I see a meth stove there?
Yeah, little pop can alcohol stove.
So what would you say, I did like to ask a question to people at the end there, your best bit of kit, worst bit of kit?
I'd say the best bit has been the pack.
That's the Golight Pinnacle.
Yep, it's the Golight Pinnacle, because it was nice when I was carrying, you know, 26 pounds worth of food, and you could have it, you know, fully strapped out, and you know the bag will take it. It's about on the edge of its weight range, but and even now with almost nothing in it, I can strap it down, and it'll still tighten up nice, and it'll just sit on your back just the same way. So I think the bag definitely exceeded the expectations. The worst bit of kit, I don't know. Everything kind of has worked fairly well.
Anything too heavy, or perhaps you didn't use, or you didn't need, something like that?
I've got a couple extra shirts, or two extra shirts, that I've used one of them and not the other.
Well, that's one more than most people, I have to say.
They work well as a pillow at night, okay. but I've got clothes that I haven't worn, or just, you know, I've got an extra base layer that I never used, but I mean, I've got the vest and a fleece and two shirts on, and everything seems to work. And
so you're happy with everything else. Now, tell me a bit about the funding to come over here, because I know you got a bit of sponsorship from what's it, social and cultural studies, is it? Something along those lines?
Yeah, the university that I go to, the University of Minnesota, in the Duluth campus, doing kind of a cultural immersion thing. And it was kind of post-planned after I'd had all this planned already. And I talked to them, and they wanted me to come over and kind of experience the Scottish culture as it is, especially of the Highlands, because it's just not something you can't, you know, go on the internet or Wikipedia or look up an encyclopedia and just find out what it's like here. And so it's the Allworth Institute for International Studies. And they kind of try and bring international perspective to the campus university that they otherwise wouldn't have experienced. So I'm going to do a presentation there when I get back, probably a couple months into the semester, and it'll be about, you know, the challenge and the culture. It'll be more based on, you know, the things that I saw and what it's like in the Highlands. Because, I mean, everyone kind of sees, you know, the pictures of Glasgow and that area and what that's like. But, you know, no one really ever makes it up this far up north and, you know, to the coasts or... You know, you get to Newtonmore and Braemar, and it's in the middle of nowhere. You'd have to drive for hours to get to it, even. And it's, every place has a different culture to it, and everyone talks differently. And so, yeah, they've been real supportive of helping me out and getting information. And
are you gonna find it sort of difficult to separate the challenge people and the challenge culture? Is different, obviously, from Highland culture and so on. Have you managed to sort of separate that in your mind?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, the challenge culture kind of follows you as you go along. But I've been trying to look at, you know, the buildings and, you know, talk to some of the locals in the towns and, you know, go and talk to the shopkeepers and get off the beaten track, you know, find people who, you know, aren't trying to cater to tourists, you know, and find, you know, gamesmen and some of the land stalkers and talk to them about, you know, just what the country's like and the culture and just find people who, you know, get the perspective of what life is like up here. You know, it's completely different from anywhere else in the world, so.
The challenges as we go across Scotland, as you probably are fully aware, we're a bit of a bubble, really, a sort of self-contained bubble. Although we sort of take various routes, we do tend to sort of cling to each other in many respects. And I often wondered how the local life continues during the other 364 days of the year or whatever. Can you separate that when you actually do your presentation? Separate that from the sort of Highland life that you've listened to, you've understood from people?
Yeah, I think so. You kind of get, you know, you get the people who you're walking with and the culture that's following you across, and you talk with all these people. And then you can, I find it easy enough to go kind of away from the challenge crowd and get out and talk to the local people, like Chris at Mar-a-Lodge, managing the estate there, and, you know, he knows about the challenge. He's been doing catering to us for a couple of years, and just talking with him about, you know, what it's like to run an estate. And because I mean, as we move it across the country, we're all part of the culture, but it's vastly different when you're coming, you know, with this, you know, group of international travelers, or, you know, people from Britain and Scotland and Ireland and the States and all over the place. We kind of make our own culture as we come across, but I think it's nice to be able to just step away from all of that for a couple hours a day every now and then, and just talk to some local people and people in the shops.
So, what's your lasting impression? I mean, what would you say is the thing that's probably struck home to you most of all about that the local culture, the Scotland that you've witnessed? What will you take back as being the strongest, perhaps most surprising thing you've learned about them?
I'd say just a lot of the sense of community. I mean, people up here are so spread out, but you can walk for a day and, you know, you go through one section of Scotland and it's a community. And it's like rural, you know, farmland where your neighbors are far away. But, you know, even though they're not right next door, they're still your neighbors and you have to rely on each other. And, you know, everyone has to produce, you know, and give it to the community. And then, you know, they get their comforts back. But, yeah, I think just the sense of how strong their individual and unique culture is as you cross. And you can see it changes from place to place. But just that sense of community among people who live up here that you have to depend on each other.
Well, I have to congratulate you on finishing your first challenge. It's a great thing that you've done, especially coming over sort of blind, as it were, and come to Scotland for the first time and approaching it the way you've done. As I say, you've earned a great amount of respect from everybody else that's shared your story, even though they've just met you for 5 minutes, as you say. The final question is, would you come back and do it again?
Definitely I'd do it again. I think it'll take a little bit, graduate from school and get a job and study out, but I think the next time I find, you know, I've got the time off and over the challenge, yeah, I'll definitely do it again.
I'm sitting here with John, who's a first-timer, fellow podcaster, but in a different genre.
A little bit, yes. Games podcasting, so nothing to do with hiking.
And a man who walked across Scotland for his first challenge using a tarp, which is, I think, something to be commended. How did it go?
Went very well. I wasn't on a hugely adventurous route, so it wasn't really put to the test. There was just one area where I decided to go in the body instead of camping outside because I thought the tarp would be a bit cold.
It was pretty horrible that night, wasn't it?
Since you apparently were freezing in a tent, I made the right decision. But it's been lovely. Had some lovely camping in the trees and plenty of room under there.
Now, just looking back over the last 2 weeks, it seems extraordinary, doesn't it? I mean, sitting here now in the Park Hotel in Montrose with a pint in your hand, and you think, well, those mountains seem a long time ago now, don't they? But what were the highlights for you, John?
The main one is Loch Na Garr, because my knowledge of Scotland is pitifully limited, but I knew Loch Na Garr, and I'd always wanted to go, and on the way up I could see about 100 yards ahead, and that was it. And then it started to hail, and then the sleet came, and then we were walking through snow, and I thought, I'm not going to see much, and it just opened up beautifully. I was walking along with somebody I'd met at the Calata Lodge, and had a fantastic day, which ended in a peat bog trying to find the body at Shealy na Mark.
Oh, most days either start or end in a peat bog, and if you're very unlucky, they start and end in a peat bog itself. So, is this something you're going to do again?
Almost definitely. I think next year probably not, just sort of timing, other things happening, but I've already been sort of thinking, maybe a bit further north, maybe there, you know. I'll have a much better idea of what I want to get out of it, so I think I'll be better able to do a route and not have to wing it so much. My route was fairly set, but I knew that I'd need to allow perhaps an extra day to drop in if there was a big social event, perhaps, you know, some B&Bs here and there that I didn't know what I'd find. And I'm hoping that the next time I'll know what to do a little better.
And have you found the social side of it? Because that's one of the things that certainly surprised me when I did my first challenge, that, you know, in some ways it's as much a social event as it is a walking challenge.
Almost more in some cases. The odd thing is that I suppose I'd worried that perhaps you've got people doing it 15, 20 times and you would have this sort of clique of folks who would settle in the snug and just sit there and, you know, you'd be sitting over in a corner with a pint thinking, well, I'm sure that's very nice, maybe I'll be accepted one day. And in fact, you just keep bumping into people and you gradually get this network of folks and somebody walks into the bar and you recognise them and wave them as if you've known them for 10 years. So the social side was something I really quite opened up to.
One of the things that impressed me this year was that a lot of the new challengers, and certainly a lot of the younger ones, kind of already knew of each other through the internet, you know, through Edgeworth's Magic, through the blogs and that kind of thing, which was quite nice in a way.
Nobody knows anybody's real name, of course. We just know internet handles.
Yeah, very strange names. Some of them are very strange people. But one of the things that he's quite clear is there's a lot of people now aware of the challenge who weren't aware of it before and are thinking of doing it, and we know that a lot of the people listening to these podcasts are thinking of doing it one day. So what advice would you have for anybody who's thinking of planning it for the first time?
Well, particularly if you don't know anybody who's done it, and I'm lucky that I know somebody who's on the fourth this time, I'd use the internet to get in touch with somebody who's done it, because there's absolutely no substitute. No matter how much you look at the map, how much you read, there'll be something that looks perfectly sensible, and in fact you can't do it. And if you run into it and it's perhaps missed by one of the route vetters, you might find yourself unnecessarily having a hard day. And it... You mention any place on your potential route to somebody who's done it before, and the chances are they've been there, and they'll say, oh, in fact, there's a bothy near there, or there's good camping a mile down the road. And little bits of advice like that. I mean, certainly I haven't found anything but tremendous help from people. You know, everyone's been really keen on... There's no looking down your nose at the first-time challenges. It's just trying to get people to have the best time they can. And I think if you can get early on into a little bit of the community, you'll be much better prepared for what you're expecting.
You've obviously tackled it from a reasonably lightweight perspective, but I know from our chat last night, lightish, but also not expensive as well, which is quite important, I think.
Not hugely expensive in that, I mean, yes, a lot of the kit I've had is, you know, it does cost money, but it isn't necessarily new. So I've been wearing a smock I've had for about 8 or 9 years. Most of my Go-Lite kit was their sort of first generation of stuff. And some of that I actually won in a competition. So I got a new pair of shoes, though. The Innovates are very good. But I don't know. I don't think you have to spend an enormous amount of kit. If you look at some of the things some people are using, I mean, most people seem to be wearing Crocs in the evening. Well, you can pick up a pair of Crocs, you know, sort of discount prices. And... unless you're absolutely starting from scratch, I don't think you particularly need any specialist gear for this. You might find something that may have worked a little better than what you have, but as long as you're confident that what you've got is going to survive a couple of hundred miles, I was able to keep the costs down quite well. Until I got here and started buying the beers, of course.
Yeah, it's the ancillary costs that mount up on the challenge. And finally, one thing is a reasonably lightweight crossing. Some of those rucksacks you see on this challenge are extraordinary, aren't they?
Just on the way in here, I've just passed, I think it's an old Carrymore with a frame. And I've been hearing tales. Oh, there's a frame rucksack. I mean, I used to live in the States, and it's not that unusual to see frame rucksacks, but you don't see them still around here anymore. And when you realise that somebody's going past with an 80-litre rucksack and they're about the same age, you think, well, good luck to you, fair enough, it's obviously working.
Yeah, let's check the state of their hips and knees in about 20 years' time.
If they're still around then, yeah.
John, thanks a lot, and look forward to meeting you again in future years.
Angie, thank you very much.
Join us next time as the journey across Scotland continues on the 30th anniversary TGO Challenge 2009. Find out how easy it is to subscribe to all our free programmes. Visit our website at theoutdoorstation.co.uk or look us up on Facebook.